I would say is I'm going to shut down the virus, not the country.
I'm not going to shut down the country. I'm going to shut down the virus.
I'm going to shut down the virus.
I'm going to shut down the virus. I'll shut down the virus, not the economy.
I'm going to shut down the virus.
Once we shut down the virus,
I'm going to shut down the virus.
I'm going to shut down the virus.
I'm not going to shut down the country, but I'm going to shut down the virus.
That is China Joe Biden, President of the United States, and the promises he made as a candidate. And this is the Lars Larson Show for a Monday. Hope you all had a wonderful Thanksgiving. I know I did in my family. Welcome to the best conversation in talk journalism, where naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for more than 21 years. Yes, Joe Biden promised to shut the virus down, and he has not. He promised no vaccine mandates, yet he did precisely the opposite. And today, the federal courts have slapped down Joe Biden again. The federal courts are getting into a real habit of this. He keeps getting slapped down on things like the Remain in Mexico policy. And most recently, he got slapped down on the mandates for people who work in healthcare. As many as 30% of the people who work in healthcare in America are not vaccinated. They have made a personal choice. Joe Biden did not respect that choice, and he tried to mandate things. Here's a soundbite to remind you of the history of Joe Biden before we get to the new variant out of South Africa.
I don't think it should be mandatory. I wouldn't demand to be mandatory.
There will be no nationwide mandate. I was referring to mandates by private institutions and portions of the federal government. There will be no federal mandate.
One that's not the role of the federal government.
I don't think you'll ever see a mandating of vaccine, particularly for the general public. But you would never mandate, at least I do not think you would. I'd be pretty surprised if you mandated it for any element of the general public.
Now, that last voice, of course, was Dr. Anthony Fauci, or Dr. Fauci, as we've been calling him, because he's lied to the American public maybe more than even Joe Biden has. But today, Biden announced his travel ban, the travel ban because of the emergence from South Africa of a new form of COVID, a variant called Omicron. Now, the president calls it Omicron. That's not the way it's spelled, Joe, but whatever. The United States is slated to impose that travel ban on 8 South African nations starting today, while the European Union, Israel, the United Kingdom, and many other countries have already done the same due to the spread of that variant, which was discovered in South Africa and Botswana. And the president got questions on that travel ban just a few hours ago. Take a listen to this.
The reason for the immediate travel ban is there were a significant number of cases, unlike any other country, well, there are few around South Africa in the world. We needed time to give people an opportunity to say, get that vaccination now before it has, it's going to move around the world. I think it's almost inevitable there will be at some point that strain here in the United States.
Yeah, there probably will. But here's the question. Has Joe Biden talked about how bad this strain is? And yes, Joe Biden has imposed the same kind of travel ban that just about a year and a half ago, Joe Biden himself was calling a travel ban put in place by Donald Trump on travel from China, where the United States was getting 20,000 people from China every single day. About half of them were Americans returning from China. The other half were Chinese nationals coming to the United States for a variety of reasons. And what did Joe Biden call that kind of travel ban at the time? He called it xenophobic. He called it hysterical. He even called it racist. And yet now, President Biden is imposing a travel ban on people coming out of a country whose population is predominantly black. And the mainstream media is silent on that Biden hypocrisy. And you have to ask yourself, what do we know about Omicron? Well, first, there's the name. And let me spend a moment on that. We've been watching the World Health Organization name various variants based on the Greek alphabet, Delta, Lambda, and Nu, among others. But with Omicron, they skipped a letter. Now, I know the mainstream media is not going to tell you about that. Which letter did they skip? They skipped the letter Z, spelled XI. But here's the thing. Z is also the name of the dictator of communist China. And of course, the World Health Organization and the Biden administration, they don't want to upset the leader of China. I mean, look Look at what happens when you upset China. They try to take over the world. They build artificial islands. They build a massive military. They engineer viruses in a lab in Wuhan. If you upset the Chinese, you can end up with real trouble. But a top doctor with the South African Medical Association, who helped alert the authorities to the new virus variant, has told media outlets that Omicron has unusual but mild symptoms. Dr. Angelique Coetzee told the London Telegraph, their symptoms are so different and so mild from those I've treated before. It presents mild disease, with symptoms being sore muscles and tiredness for a day or two and just generally not feeling well, said Dr. Coetzee. So far, we have detected that those infected do not suffer the loss of taste and smell. They might have a slight cough. There are no prominent symptoms. Of those infected, some are currently being treated at home. And yet Joe Biden is out announcing a travel ban. And of course, people are curious about whether or not the president is going to slap new mask mandates or vaccine mandates on. Take a listen to the question and answer from today.
It spreads. How dangerous
is
this?
No, this is the mask mandate.
Work to do in that area.
Many states. In any case, Joe Biden announced that he says not at this time. We're not going to have, but he does give the advice. He wants mask mandates on Americans. Of course, this past weekend, when he took off to spend Thanksgiving at a friend's house, the friend is a billionaire. He went shopping in Nantucket. And when he thought the cameras were not on him, Joe Biden wasn't wearing a mask, but he says all Americans should be wearing a mask. Biden and his administration have repeatedly promised there would be no vaccine mandate, and yet he enacted one anyway. That has led to mandates that has led to the firing of police officers, firefighters, paramedics, some emergency rooms in America shutting down, firehouses being closed in major cities. All of this because of mandates. And guess what happened now? Well, the federal courts have decided that that mandate does not work. Federal workers will not be published or punished for failing to comply with President Joe Biden's vaccine mandate until the new year, according to the White House. And why is that? Because the federal courts have already decided the vaccine mandate is not legal. And so you have to ask yourself, why would the president keep doing things that the courts keep striking down? And the end result, as I've told you before, is that he knows that by the time the courts get to those mandates and rule that they are illegal and unconstitutional, those institutions will have already fired doctors, nurses, paramedics, police officers, ferry boat pilots. The list goes on and on and on. In fact, some of you are subject to those mandates. And unfortunately, you've already got your pink slip. But Joe Biden, he doesn't get his notice from the federal courts until today. Glad to have you with me. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. The Northwest Nonsense is next.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Now, some states have actually put a ban on any kind of vaccine passport. Not Oregon and Washington. Both of those states want citizens to submit to an electronic version that lets you prove you're vaccinated. I raised this issue last week when it became clear that Oregon Health Authority has already made plans to have an electronic version of a vaccine passport. And if you say, well, how's that going to work? Well, you'll load it up on your smartphone. Of course, people without smartphones, they may be out of luck. And then every time you want to go out and go to some public place, if they impose the same kind of restrictions that Jay Inslee has imposed and that King County has imposed, then you might have to pull out your smartphone and prove that you're vaccinated. And it opens up a whole list of concerns that do not apparently concern Kate Brown and Jay Inslee, the governors of Oregon and Washington. Does the government even have the authority to do such a thing? I don't think they do, but they're claiming they do. And so far, that seems to have worked out for Inslee and Brown, who just go ahead and do it until somebody tells them not to, because they understand that for the most part, they own the courts in Oregon and Washington. And the judges will just say, oh, Kate wants to do it? Yeah, I guess that's okay. Does it create a database of personal healthcare information? Now, I've reminded you and people have reminded me that HIPAA only applies to healthcare institutions. So if you work for a private employer that's not a healthcare institution and you say you're violating my HIPAA rights, well, HIPAA, like it or not, is a federal law that only applies to healthcare institutions like clinics and doctors and dentist's offices, hospitals, things like that. But the state does operate clinics and healthcare facilities. So doesn't it violate HIPAA by having this kind of database? Here's another concern. Since it's designed for smart device, so-called smart devices, smartphones, wouldn't it automatically discriminate against the poor? Now, realize I'm using one of the left-wing arguments against Kate Brown and Jay Inslee. The left usually argues why insisting that somebody get a driver's license to be able to vote, why that would be economically discriminatory. Somebody out there doesn't have a driver's license. Now, I've never actually seen or heard of an actual example of somebody in America who can't afford a driver's license, but that's the argument they make. If you're going to insist on some kind of electronic vaccine passport, isn't that going to automatically discriminate against both the poor and, by extension, to people of color disproportionately? We all know that many smartphone apps aggregate other information from your phone, including who you associate with, where you travel, your social media use. Will the government promise, if anybody out there still believes the promises made by government, not to gather and store that kind of data? Will the businesses that scan the passport also be able to aggregate customer records for business purposes? I'm sure some businesses might find it handy. Hey, we have to scan this person's smartphone. We'll find out all kinds of info about them. Will a record be kept of the customers who visit such businesses? Booze, like Oregon or Washington liquor stores, pot, adult entertainment, things like that. Are you going to have a database of that information as well? And will the vast records database of the state allow cross-checking of vaccination records with income, political registration, concealed carry, criminal records, the list goes on and on? And will churches have to scan your vaccine passport for entry to go into a church? Because I can see a whole bunch of problems, constitutional problems with that. From our email, Ian Holtz writes in, Lars, whatever happened to the only two things that are guaranteed in life are death and taxes? Now they want to make it death taxes and your COVID-19 vaccine. Just a thought. And from Twitter, this one comes in. Coco posted this. Oregon and Washington have millions of good, liberty-loving people who've been abandoned. We are being actively silenced by the government and our media. We do not agree with the rioting in our cities, and we do not consent to the threat of medical tyranny. And then my question of the day, and this is my question. I saw that TriMet, one of the major transit agencies in the Northwest, is now offering hiring bonuses. And here's the question I've got. TriMet's ridership has gone down dramatically. Now, some of that was due to the pandemic, but a lot of it was happening already. TriMet has seen falling ridership, per capita ridership, for literally decades. Why are they now offering massive bonuses of $2,500 on top of the average pay of $68,000 a year, plus a public pension on top of that? And they're offering to hire more people at a time when fewer and fewer people are actually riding transit. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
I want to suggest something that the Daily Grill goes to the Democrat Party that has managed to do this. One of the least popular presidents in American history is now Joe Biden, and his popularity rates keep falling. And then, of course, he's got his vice president, who's even less popular than Joe is. But do you know who's less popular than Joe? That would be the worst governor in the United States. Now, the best governors, 9 out of 10 of the most popular governors in America are Republicans. So who do you suppose comes in at the absolute bottom of the list? Well, that would be Kate Brown. Kate Brown is just a little bit more popular than Joe Biden, but she is the least popular governor in the entire country. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our email of the day, and you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. This one comes in from Henry, and it's brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest. Now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Well, they're a private institution. They can do what they want. Online at RiverCityUSA.com/careers. Henry says, Lars, I've been listening for a long time. Love the show. I'm a CDL driver, and I've heard of the nationwide shortage of drivers in many industries. Oregon DMV has stopped issuing CDL drive tests recently and moved to third-party testers. You have to wait as long as 6 months to be able to get your drive test. I cannot believe that this is what we've become. Correct me if I'm wrong. I just wanted to see if you could look into the matter. I'm not savvy with that kind of thing. I enjoy it when you do cover the real stories that matter to working men and women that affect us all. Thank you, signed Henry. Henry, it's an absolutely great question. And that is, if you need more drivers and states are slow walking all the driver apps, that doesn't make any sense. Let's go to the calls. Don's on the line in Seattle listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KVI. Don, we're close to the break, but what's on your mind?
Lars, they're very quick to mandate this vaccine, but yet they won't do the voter ID. They refuse to do the voter ID.
Isn't that crazy? I mentioned that last week. The same Democrats who say you cannot demand voter ID for somebody to be able to cast a ballot, but we can demand your ID to show your personal, private, medical information, including whether or not you have chosen to be vaccinated or not. It's the kind of hypocrisy that you usually get from Democrats, because with Democrats, if they didn't have double standards, they'd have no standards at all. Don, thanks for the call. Back in a moment, and we're going to talk about how big a problem Omicron really is. Come back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com, and I always tell you, I'm not the smartest guy in the room, but I can get the smartest guys and gals into the room, and one of them is Dr. Joel Zinberg, who's a senior fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Doc, welcome back to the program. Thanks for taking the time today, as we're all learning more about Omicron, or Omicron, if you listen to Joe Biden.
Glad to be here.
So tell me about this. I want to start with something really radical. So if you'll excuse the radical nature of this, we're now hearing from doctors in South Africa that Omicron, which they jumped to because the name Z, the World Health Organization, didn't like using the name of the dictator of communist China as the name of the newest variant, so they skipped the alphabet letter and went to Omicron or Omicron. But the doctors say this stuff is really mild compared to the way COVID usually presents itself. If that's the case, it sounds like in some ways not something to worry about, I guess almost something to welcome, in the sense that if you're going to get it and have mild symptoms, then you end up with the natural immunity from getting it, and maybe all the vaccine nonsense is for naught. I'll start with that kind of radical thought, and Doc, go wherever you want with it.
Well, the real problem with this is we don't know very much about it, but you're correct. The initial report coming from South Africa was a report of multiple mild cases. In fact, they were unusually mild, and they only stuck around for a day or two before the people were all better. And that was the initial report. But what's concerned doctors around the world is the fact that there are probably about 50 mutations in this Omicron variant, and 30 of them or so are on the spike protein, and that's what's involved in hooking the virus up to invade our cells. So the fear is that, you know, these mutations might make it more transmissible. And of course, no one knows if that's in fact the case. Will the disease become more virulent, and will it in any way impact our natural and vaccine immunity?
Well, and in fact, do we know anything about whether or not Joe Biden again took the opportunity today to say everybody should go get vaccinated and wear the mask, which he wasn't doing this weekend when he was on vacation. But I guess if you're hanging out with billionaires, then maybe you're not as susceptible to disease. Maybe that's what he thinks. But so is this stuff, does the vaccine do any good with this at all? Because we've seen that the vaccine doesn't seem to cover everything. It didn't seem to cover Delta very well at all.
Well, it actually did cover Delta well. And what the vaccine has covered, most importantly, is that it has kept people from becoming severely ill, hospitalized, and dying. There was some drop-off in terms of its ability to keep you from being infected, and that's probably true of all the variants over time. But the vaccines have been remarkable in that they have been effective against all the variants, and there's every reason to think that they're going to remain effective even against this new Omicron variant. They may not be as effective, but that remains to be seen. But no one has shown anything to indicate that they will be less effective or ineffective.
Okay, so tell me this. Why the rather dramatic reaction to it, with some countries saying we're going to put a travel ban in place immediately? Joe Biden says it goes into effect today, the 29th. If it's not that terribly different from the other variants, then why the greater than usual reaction to it by the U.S. government?
The problem is some of the mutations that they're seeing here were noted in some of the earlier variants, and they were associated with things like greater transmissibility or perhaps lowered immune response. Now, whether it will play out, you know, when you have all these different mutations together in one variant, and whether they'll act in exactly the same way as they acted in the earlier variants, no one knows yet. But some of these mutations, you know, were of some concern in earlier variants, and thankfully those earlier variants never really took hold. But, you know, that's the concern, that if this thing takes hold. But by the way, you know, most people don't realize there have been lots of variants that have just never become terribly widespread. So this Omicron may fall into that category, too. It's just too early to say.
Okay, so tell me this. At the end of the day, is natural immunity that which you get by having had the disease and successfully recovered from it? Is it as good, is it better than, or is it not as good as what you get from the shot, especially considering that the shots, we're now told, have to be boosted perhaps every 6 months?
Well, this has been a matter of great debate, but I've written about this multiple times, and I think the CDC and some other experts have finally come around, that the natural situation is that natural immunity, the immunity you get from having a disease and recovering, is generally speaking as good or better than a vaccine immunity. And that appears to be the case with the coronavirus, you know, that we're seeing with COVID. There have been a number of studies. The CDC finally did a review of the evidence about 2-3 weeks ago, where they acknowledged that both natural immunity and vaccine immunity are very good and quite effective at protecting you from severe disease and death.
So, doctor, given that, should the government recognize that if they're going to push things like vaccine passports, which are being pushed in some states, should they say if you've had it already, that can show on your vaccine passport, or that counts? So somebody who's already had the disease can say to the boss, I don't need the vaccine, I've already had it, except I'm not seeing anybody. There are some foreign countries that recognize having had it as being equivalent to, but I'm not seeing that happen in the United States. If they're truly following the science, should they recognize natural immunity as equivalent to getting the shot?
Yeah, I mean, I've written that multiple times, and I think it makes no sense to impose mandates on employees, particularly employees who are so important to the community, like firefighters and policemen, if they can demonstrate that they had and recovered from COVID and got an immune response. There's, you know, why take those people out of the workforce? There's no advantage to requiring them to be immunized. Now, the argument is often made, oh, but, you know, they'll get better immunity if they also get a vaccine on top of the natural immunity. And that argument's true, by the way, if you get a booster on top of being fully vaccinized. But no one has yet said, oh, well, we're not going to allow people who are fully vaccinated to work unless they get a booster. So until they do something like that, there's no reason to impose mandates on people who can demonstrate natural immunity.
Because, Doc, one of the numbers I saw today from CDC, they said 30% of healthcare workers in the United States are still unvaccinated. And you say, I mean, we've seen hospitals shut down. We've seen emergency rooms shut down. We've seen fire stations shut down by these mandates. Should we be pushing all these people out of their essential positions because of these mandates, especially since some of the people being pushed out have already had it?
Right. Well, look, I would strongly encourage everyone to get vaccinated. If there's some reason, though, that you do not want to get vaccinated or can't be vaccinated, yet you can demonstrate natural immunity, you should be allowed to work. And the good news when you talk about healthcare workers is, you know, that's the figures you're talking about are healthcare workers taken as a homogenous group. But
right.
In fact, if you look at the people who have the most patient contact, and I mean by physicians, nurses, the technicians who are in daily contact, the figures are actually substantially higher. There are healthcare workers who have much less contact with patient populations who are less well vaccinated. But for the folks who are in most direct contact with patients, the figures are over 90%.
Although, Doc, I've got to tell you, you wouldn't believe the number of doctors and nurses I've had on this show who said, I'm getting fired because I won't get the shot. I don't want to get the shot. And they're being told that's OK, then you're fired, or we're going to put you on permanent, status where you don't get scheduled and you don't get a paycheck, which for me is the same thing as getting fired. Dr. Joel Zinberg from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We'll be back in a moment. You've got the Lawrence Larson Show on a Monday.
Inflation. It's important to note that the American people are mostly fixated on inflation. There's no relief in sight.
Gas prices.
Everything you're paying this much for a gallon of gas? In some parts of California, they're paying $4.50 a gallon.
Multi-trillion dollar government programs.
The price tag for this bill, $1.75 trillion. And the recovery bill passed in March is close to $5 trillion.
Big Brother has taken control and wants more from you. Every single day. This is Government Gone Wild.
Let's do the wild.
I would consider this an example of Government Gone Wild, and I'll get to your calls in just a moment. But consider the fact that Portland, Oregon has now set and exceeded records that it has never seen before when it comes to violence. 113 shootings in the month of September, 129 in October. We know that the number for November, when it finally comes in a couple of days, is likely to be higher. As of the 24th of November, 5 days ago, there had been 79 homicides this year, a record well past the previous high. You have to go all the way back to 1987 for that. So what's the police bureau going to do? They got rid of the gang team. They got rid of the gun violence reduction team. And they have replaced it with the amorphous name Focused Intervention Team, the FIT team. And what exactly is the FIT team going to do? They say they're going to look for different ways of resolving gun violence. Well, it's not the guns that are being violent. It's people. And let me point this out. The big objection to the gun violence reduction team, as quoted by our friends at OPB, an investigation by the city auditor found the gun violence reduction team disproportionately targeted people of color. Well, let me cite the Department of Justice, the Biden Department of Justice. Based on the FBI's uniform crime reporting, black people were overrepresented among persons of interest for violent crimes that were not fatal, 33%. Now, since most of that is black men make up 6.5% of the national population, an even smaller percentage in the Pacific Northwest, and yet represent 33% of non-fatal violent crimes. When it comes to murder, black suspects and black people convicted of the crime of murder are almost 50% of all the murders in America, and 90% of their victims are other black citizens. So, black men make up 6.5% of the population and yet make up almost half of all the murders in the country. And yet you've got little committees or the city auditor saying you can't do this. You're arresting too many people of color. And what does Gina Ronning, who's one of the members of a community oversight group, say? Our mission is to understand and work with the police bureau in coming up with community-informed strategies of dealing with gun violence, but at the same time, doing it in a responsible and culturally and racially responsive way. That's the quote from her. Ronning describes herself as generally critical of the police, but she's been impressed by the cops who volunteered so far. So go out and do something about violent crime. And even though there is one particular group in America that is overwhelmingly associated based on their percentage of population with violent crime, don't do anything about that. This is where it gets crazy. Let's go to Ron in Tacoma. Hey, Ron, welcome to a Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Well, what's on my mind today is, when we got COVID-19, the Democrat Party, they couldn't wait to get that disease over here. There was absolutely nothing to do with trying to stop it coming to the United States. Suddenly, this one here, they kind of think maybe they shouldn't let it in the United States, so they wait till Monday. So, you know what confuses me, Lars? I don't know if you've ever watched Titanic, but it was amazing how they wouldn't let you on the boat, even if you had life. We were able to keep diseases out of this country like a bolide for most of my childhood life.
Ellis Island.
For some reason, until Obama got in office and decided to import this disease to treat it, there was the beginning of bringing foreign diseases in. So I'm just wondering, does the Democrats think that maybe these diseases will do the job that American diseases won't do? Do we have a disease shortage? Maybe you can fill me in on why we can no longer keep them out of the country.
Well, and consider this, Ron. The big guy for the Democrats now is Dr. Anthony Fauci. I think most of us distrust the guy because he has lied through his teeth for much of the last year and a half. But he was on television this weekend saying, well, you know, everybody who comes into the country has COVID testing and COVID records and all that. He carefully does not mention the 2 million illegal aliens who have flooded across our border under Open Borders Joe Biden since January of this year. 2 million people who came in without even the regular vaccinations that we've taken as routine over the decades, and certainly not vaccinated for COVID and not tested for COVID. And you know that on this show, we've talked to people like the mayor of McAllen, Texas, who said there were times when the place where they stuffed all these illegal aliens for a while until they could distribute them around the country, as many as 20 to 25% of the illegals coming across the border have COVID. Have it. Not just that they haven't been vaccinated or they haven't been tested. They have the disease. So you have a huge number of people coming in untested, unchecked, unvaccinated, the whole nine yards. And then Anthony Fauci goes on television and says, well, we check everybody who's coming into the country. And then I guess under his breath says, except, of course, for 2 million illegal aliens. And again, that's a policy of the Biden administration, saying we're going to open up the doors and let this just come into our country. Glad to have you with me on a Monday. Always glad to take your calls. Our Twitter poll today, a little unusual, with Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey's resignation. Will there be less censorship, more censorship, or about the same censorship from Twitter? You can vote on that at Lars Larson Show, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services, ultimatetruckservice.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And naysayers always go to the head of the line. You know, I've been watching as the Pacific Northwest has dealt with the unemployment that was caused by the various shutdowns and lockdowns and all the restrictions the last year and a half, as America and the Pacific Northwest have dealt with the effects of the COVID pandemic and locally epidemic. I saw some numbers recently, though, and I wanted to reach out to Amy VanderVliet, who is the regional economist for the Oregon Employment Department, because they made me curious. And she's a young lady who specializes in numbers, so I thought she could explain it to a dummy like me. Ms. VanderVliet, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you, but here's the thing I'm curious about. So now I'm just a simple guy who can barely balance his checkbook, but did we lose 50,000 net jobs?
Yes, net was 50,000 below pre-pandemic highs.
Does that also include the airport and travelers that if the number of I saw that over Thanksgiving, the number of air travelers had almost come back to pre-pandemic levels. But obviously the airport employs a lot of people to load luggage, unload luggage, prepare meals and all that. Is that counted in leisure and hospitality or is that in a different industry?
It's spread across several industries. It's spread across. It is included definitely in leisure and hospitality. And then there's also employment in air transportation. That's a separate sector. And then there's a bunch of industries that support travel and tourism and the airport that are spread across other industries. So it's pretty spread out, but I would say a large chunk is in leisure and hospitality.
So I'm talking to Amy VanderVliet, who's a regional economist for the Oregon Employment Department. Are there any indicators that indicate whether those 50,000 jobs are likely to come back at some point?
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, if you look at the forecast put out by the Office of Economic Analysis, they do a quarterly report and forecast on the state's economic and revenue situation. And they expect statewide that we'll recover all our jobs that we lost during the pandemic by about a year from now, about, you know, fall, early winter of next year. So they expect a complete recovery.
So that means that all those bars and restaurants and hotels, since that obviously takes a lot of employees to run those kinds of businesses.
Now, the recovery will look different depending upon the industry. So they're not saying that all industries will recover by the middle of the end of next year, but some industries will certainly lag others in their recovery. And I think leisure and hospitality is one of those industries. Their recovery is going to be slower, while others will see a faster recovery.
Okay, so can you tell me this? You're the regional economist. I'm just curious, if our unemployment rate is already really low, not quite as low as pre-pandemic, but and we have 50,000 jobs that might come back over the next year, where are the workers going to come from to fill those jobs? And are they sitting on the sidelines now, according to, you know, labor force participation rates and things like that? Or are they going to have to come in from outside the region?
It's a mix. There's no one answer. Portland has traditionally, and Oregon too, has traditionally depended upon net immigration for much of their, maybe up to 2/3 of our labor supply. So yes, we do depend on people moving into the area for our labor force. And we'll see that happening. Our population is still growing slower than it was prior to the pandemic and in the heydays of the 90s and 2000s. But we still expect to see population growth, which will obviously increase our labor force. And we also see people, there are still statewide in Oregon, there are still about 60,000 people who aren't working right now because of COVID-related reasons. And so you could say that those people are sitting on the sidelines, and we'll see likely many of those people return to the labor force as COVID recedes.
Because when I've checked with Oregon Employment Department and said, how many jobs do we have available? I think the last time I checked was maybe a month or a month and a half ago. They said, you got 100,000 jobs out there, or 95,000 jobs. And it's made me wonder, if we have 95,000 jobs available, why is anybody sitting out and not working? Do you have any insights to that, since you're the numbers lady?
Like I just said, fear, people have a fear of getting or spreading COVID, and 60,000 of those people in Oregon are in Oregon, and they're not working because of COVID. So that's one aspect of it. People are still struggling with childcare, and that should ease as you get the full return of in-person learning. People are still maybe not working because they have a cushion, a financial cushion, from saving. People didn't spend as much during the pandemic, so people have accumulated savings, excess savings. And so some people might be living off their savings. Other people have realized that maybe they only need one earner in the household instead of two, at least for a while. So maybe some people are choosing not to work because they can depend on their spouse's income. There are many different reasons, and it's impossible for us to tease out the numbers, the exact numbers and shares behind those reasons.
Does that suggest to you that it's going to be really tough for those 50,000 jobs to grow back over the next year if the employers are out looking, saying, I can't find anybody who wants to work for me? Because the fear part of that, is that likely to change over the next year? Do you see that? I mean, I don't know that there's a fear index that the economists follow, but maybe there is. I mean, how do you get, if they were fearful a year ago and they're fearful today, how do we know where they're going to be a year from now?
I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. The fear part of it?
Well, when you said that people are not working right now because there are jobs available, but they're not working because they fear getting COVID, so they don't want to go back to work and perhaps be exposed, does that go away?
Well, COVID's in control. It was a COVID recession. It's a COVID-driven recovery. So those 60,000 people, when and if they feel comfortable with the level of risk that COVID presents in the workplace and in their everyday lives, as that eases, you'll see them come back. But who knows if, you know, COVID is in control. Will it be a year? Will it be 2 years? Will it be 6 months? We don't know.
Will some of that change based on how the government hands out benefits during the next year or so? Because there are states that have cut back on the benefits and there are states that have not. I think Oregon and Washington are states that have not cut back on the benefits for the non-working.
Well, we did. I mean, the extended and enhanced UI benefits, unemployment insurance benefits, they ended in September. And there have also been reports and studies out there that have compared states that ended unemployment benefits earlier than others. to see what the impact was on people returning to the workforce. And I'm pretty sure the survey or the report showed that in those states that had that cut off benefit earlier than others, you might have seen one out of every eight workers return to the labor force because the UI benefits expiring. It was an impact, but it wasn't a huge impact.
Ms. VanderVliet, I appreciate you taking the time. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That is Amy VanderVliet, who's the regional economist for the Oregon Employment Department. 50,000 jobs lost, but maybe they'll come back over the next year. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and your emails. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails, go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to take your calls on the Radio Northwest Network. Our Twitter poll today with Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey's resignation. He's leaving. He's still the founder of the company, but he's leaving the company in terms of running it. Will there be less censorship or more censorship or about the same amount? I think Jack Dorsey's departure is not going to reduce the censorship. If anything, it's probably going to double down now. But that's my vote on it. I would say more censorship is on the way. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, a bit ago, I told you about the new effort by one police agency in the Northwest, in this case, Portland. Although I don't think that Seattle's going to be any different. They're all trying to be woke and PC, but they've created this new focused intervention team because having a gang team seemed to be the wrong focus. I thought it was exactly the right focus. Go after the gangs. According to the FBI, of the shootings and of the murders in that city in particular, about 60% of them are attributable to gang activity. If so, go after the gangs. Well, they couldn't do that. So they called it the Gun Violence Reduction Team, as though the guns are being violent, not people. In the same way that over this last weekend, as CNN kept doing stories about how in Waukesha, Wisconsin, a car drove through the Christmas parade and hurt and killed people, they didn't talk anything about the driver of the car, who was himself a black man and also somebody who had been vocal in being anti-white, in being anti a number of things. So he was a guy who had a bone to pick. And if we had flipped that situation, if there had been a white suspect who was arrested and charged with six murders, and you said, well, what do we know about it? Well, he said negative things about people of color. You'd say, well, then what you have is a hate crime. But, of course, they don't want to call Waukesha a hate crime. So it's as though CNN wants to blame the SUV rather than blaming the person who was driving the SUV. So what does Portland do? They say we're going to have a new focused intervention team. And I pointed out that one of the problems they're trying to solve, it's not a problem, is that an audit of the gun violence reduction team said you disproportionately target people of color. And I pointed out to you that the Department of Justice, the federal DOJ, says that unfortunately, black people are overrepresented among persons arrested for violent crimes that are non-fatal, and they are especially overrepresented among violent crimes that are fatal, homicides. And you say, well, there's a problem there. I said, yeah, I agree there's a problem there, and 90% of their victims are people of color. But you should go after the criminal. They say, well, no, because then that leads to arresting too many black people. You say, well, why is it a problem if you're arresting the person for doing a crime? I've pointed out to people 100 times, if you look at state prisons across America, 90% of the people in prison in any given state in America are men, and only 10% are women. And I don't hear anybody saying, you ought to arrest more women and put them in prison. No, we arrest people for committing crimes. The fact that 90% of the crimes that send you to prison involve men as the perpetrators, and only 10% involve women as the perpetrators. Nobody sees that as a problem, even though women actually make up the majority of the American population. It's a small majority, but they outnumber the men by a small amount. And yet they're only 10% of the prison population. Well, I got an email from a gentleman, and I thought it was right on target because he's right about what happens in the schools, and this affects your kids. Ken says, Lars, I hope this is your correct email address. It is talk@LarsLarson.com. I heard you talk about gun violence in Oregon and how it's disproportionately people of color. A family member of mine has the same issue in Portland Public Schools. She works at an elementary school and was writing out referrals for naughty kids. Her principal questioned her why so many of the kids were children of color and not as many for other kids. She told the principal, "I just write them out when the kids act bad." The principal basically called her a racist. I told her to just stop writing any referrals at all. This is ridiculous. What has become of the school system? They're creating the next generation of juvenile delinquents. And I would agree with that notion as well. And it's your kids that are affected, but it's the tax dollars from all of us that are being misspent by schools who refuse to say, punish every kid who misbehaves. Well, then we'll punish too many Hispanic kids and black kids. Well, be that as it may, write up the kids for creating a problem. If you then say, no, the solution is don't write the kids up at all, that's what some of the schools have actually done, and it makes no sense at all. Let's go to Dan. And if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Hey, Dan, sorry about the long wait. What's on your mind today?
No worries. You know, there's all this worry about Hunter's laptop and, you know, his dealings with China. There's Fauci, there's Milley, those dealings with China. But what we aren't talking about is how the three governors on the West Coast met with the Chinese governor or the Chinese president in 2015 to discuss climate change, when really, if we look down the road of where we are now, it had nothing to do with climate change. It's more about political climate change. They're allowing the DAs to not prosecute people. You got Antifa running complete logistics of everything that they're doing in North Portland, and it's all hands off. You know, we don't have any oversight of what's going on here.
Well, and the deep irony, Dan, of having somebody like Kate Brown or Jay Inslee meet with China or representatives of the Chinese government, no matter who they are, is that China is the biggest single polluter on Earth right now. And you say, well, hold on. If they're the biggest polluter, what are they doing to fix it? And the answer is, under the Paris Climate Accord, they get to keep increasing their pollution for the next 10 years or so. What is the United States supposed to do? Well, we've already cut our CO2 output by 20% over the last decade or so, and we're cutting it more. And you say, well, then we're not the problem, they are. Do you suppose Kate Brown says to the Chinese representatives, by the way, you folks are the problem, we're actually solving it, you folks are not? Do you suppose she does that?
I really don't think that conversation had anything to do with climate change. I think it had to do with, you know, what they're doing in these three states. In Oregon here, I had a friend who got two paper ballots in the mail. And nobody's saying anything. That, you know what I mean? There's the mailman. He delivers the ballots. It says official voting ballot in red, bold, on the envelope. And doesn't know that this person shouldn't receive two envelopes.
No, and
there's a lot of I don't know coming out of this administration. If I said I don't know at my job, people would die.
Yeah, and Dan, if we had good secretaries of state who are overall in charge of the election systems, you'd have a hard audit. And I can tell you, do you have a credit card?
Yep.
Have you ever had a call from the company saying, "Hey, we've declined to purchase. It was outside your pattern." You ever had that happen?
I have.
I have too. They once said, "Lars, were you in Oakland, California? And did you get a $500 money order at the Walmart in Oakland and have it sent to a store in Arizona?" And I said, "That was not me." And they said, "Okay, good," because we cut it. And you know what was going on. Somebody got a hold of a number and they said, "I'm going to send this $500 money order to a Walmart in Arizona. And my buddy will walk in and say, 'I'm Lars Larson. I want to get my money order.'" They'd cash it and be out the door. And so if you took that same technology that all the credit card companies look for patterns, and they look for things that are out of pattern, like when you have 40 people registered at the same small apartment to vote, as we hear about from people who are doing political campaigns, and they're walking down the street with a list of voters, and they say, "Hey, there are 40 registered voters at this one address." You would think that even a blind squirrel could find that kind of acorn. Dan, thanks so much for the call. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. You know, I have a dog in the fight on this one. Actually, two. One is that I own guns and I believe in the Second Amendment. And I think that more guns equals less crime, which happens to be the title of one of Dr. John Lott's books. But he is also with the Crime Prevention Research Center, which is a center that I serve on the board of directors of, without compensation, by the way. But if I have a dog in the fight, it's that. Dr. Lott, welcome back. And I wanted to talk to you about some of the polling that's been done about where Americans and their attitudes seem to be headed with regard to gun control. We now have a president who has not been shy about talking about his favoring more gun controls, more laws, more rules, more regulations. And he represents a party that always seems to back every new rule or regulation when it comes to guns. Do the American people actually support that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a sea change over the last 5 years. We've seen, according to Gallup, a 15 percentage point drop in support for gun control. There's a new survey that just came out from Quinnipiac, which also showed a similar large drop. But one thing that seems to be clear across these polls is that the drop in support for gun control has been primarily with independents. To some extent, with Republicans, though they were much lower to begin with. But you've seen an increase in support for stricter gun control laws among Democrats. In both the Quinnipiac and Gallup polls, 91% of Democrats support stricter gun control laws. In the Quinnipiac, for example, only 13% of Republicans felt the same way. But just to give you an idea of how stark the differences are, and provide a little bit of context for when Democrats talk about reasonable or types of gun control laws or common sense type laws. 40% of Democrats like the idea of a complete ban on civilian ownership of handguns. Only 6% of Republicans think that. And so you have these polls that show that we've never seen such a large partisan divide between Democrats and Republicans on the issues of gun control. And you look at something like so-called assault weapons bans. The Gallup poll had a discussion about semi-automatic guns. You know, I don't think most people realize what they're being asked about there when they're saying it. But you're finding in the high 80% range, like 88% of Democrats support a ban on these semi-automatic guns. And, you know, so it really, you're not going to see Democrats, I don't think, moving away from their strong support for gun control, despite the fact that the Quinnipiac poll, for example, showed that by a 49 to 44% margin, voters as a whole opposed having new gun control laws.
Well, and yet, so they're looking at it saying no matter what the polls show, no matter how unpopular the idea is, they're wedded to it. But that's an amazing number. 91% of Democrats support stricter laws. 40% of Democrats want to see an outright ban on the ownership of pistols by civilians. I mean, that's kind of stunning, isn't it?
It is. It's not exactly clear how they fit that into reasonable and common sense gun control laws to see a complete ban on civilian ownership of handguns. You know, there are lots of other interesting things in these surveys. Rasmussen had a survey that just came out that dealt with the issue of national registration system for all guns. Democrats supported that by about a 2-to-1 margin. Republicans opposed it by about a 2-to-1 margin. Independents also opposed it. But what was most interesting is 2/3 of Republicans thought that registration would, quote, eventually lead to confiscation of all guns, unquote.
I agree with that.
But, you know, it's not just conspiracy theorists who think that it will lead to eventual confiscation of guns. 40% of Democrats, most of the Democrats who supported registration themselves believed that it would lead to confiscation of all guns. And one thing that just came out recently, the Washington Free Beacon obtained leaked documents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, where the Biden administration has apparently found what they think is a loophole in laws that forbid them from creating a national registration system, where they've collected and compiled the list of 54 million names of American gun owners. And they're pushing additional changes in regulations that would require licensed dealers to have to report that information directly to the ATF so they could continue to expand that list.
Even though I'm talking to Dr. John Lott, from the who's the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, but doctor, doesn't the Brady handgun bill, the one that was passed after the attempt on President Reagan's life and the attempt that actually ended up taking eventually the life of James Brady, the press secretary, wasn't that bill, didn't it specifically say the government is not allowed to maintain a database of gun owners in America?
But it said that they couldn't use the information that they obtained for when they did the background checks for more than 24 hours. The Biden administration says, well, you know, if you literally read the law the way it is, we're not directly obtaining it from the background checks. They're trying to obtain it through other means. And so whether it's the licensed dealers or others, they're saying they're claiming that they're still obeying the rule there, the letter of the law, even if not the spirit of the law that's there. But you know, to me, one of the things that comes across from these surveys is the belief that Democrats think it's okay to go and ban private ownership of guns. Republicans and independents don't feel that way. And I think if you look at a lot of the different types of rules that Democrats are pushing, that Biden's pushing, it's not hyperbole to see that they want to go and do it. You look at Biden's nominee to head the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. She's calling for debanking of what she calls, quote, socially suboptimal industries. Now, that includes not just firearms. It includes the oil industry, for example. But, you know, this is a revival on steroids of the Obama administration's Operation Choke Point, where the federal government pressured banks into closing businesses' accounts. I mean, try running a company without finding a financial institution which will handle your credit card statements, handle lines of credit, handle check cashing, handle the other things that financial institutions do. And, of course, then you also have, I mean, these are just two of the regulations. You also have Biden's so-called zero-tolerance policy to what he calls rogue gun dealers. You know, nobody wants gun dealers secretly selling guns out of the back of their store to criminals, but that's not what Biden's going after. What he's saying is that one paperwork mistake, no matter how trivial or inconsequential, now means that you're going to lose your business license. It's going to be the end of your business. Now, I mean, I've talked to firearm dealers. I'm sure you probably have, too.
I have
a lot.
They're
going to be going back. If you go back over their last 15 years of records, where you're talking about many thousands of guns that particularly the larger stores may have sold over that period of time, you're telling me that the government can't find one tiny, trivial paperwork mistake in those thousands and thousands of forms?
Of course they are. Dr. John Lott from the Crime Prevention Research Center, the author of Gun Control Myths, How Politicians, the Media, and Botched Studies Have Twisted the Facts on Gun Control. Doctor, it's a pleasure to have you on. Back in a moment with your calls at 866-439-5277. Naysayers go to the head. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday, live on the Radio Northwest Network, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 21 years. It'll be 22 in a month or so. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You may have heard the news about Omicron or Omicron, and right now my email is just about evenly split between the people who say, Lars, it starts with a long O sound, Omicron, or it could be Omicron. As I said, the email's about evenly split, or you could go with Joe Biden's version, which is Omicron. Now, I don't know where he came up with that one, but apparently Tony Fauci wants to keep his job badly enough that he decided to mimic what the president actually said and call it Omicron as well, although it has too many letters in it for that. In any case, you may have also heard that Twitter's CEO, Jack Dorsey, has decided to step down. He's always bragged that Twitter was a founder-led company, but he's decided he's taken enough heat. He's going to hand off the job to somebody else who, I guess, based on his background, may actually be worse when it comes to censorship. But I'm going to offer you three choices: less, more, or the same. Will Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey's resignation mean that there is going to be more censorship on Twitter, less censorship on Twitter, or about the same? I would say it's probably going to be more censorship from Twitter. And don't forget the fact that that laptop story, the one involving Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, as Joe Biden calls him, the smartest man that Joe Biden has ever met in his life. Consider all the people that Joe Biden has ever met in his lifetime, and he thinks up his coked up son is the smartest guy he ever met. But he has managed to make millions and millions of dollars through some fairly sleazy deals. So in any case, Twitter managed to shut that story down, but good. Even though published by the New York Post at the time and heading up to an election, it still managed to silence most of the repeat tweets of that story around America. That left an awful lot of people who never got a chance to take a look at that story. And we're finding out more and more about it today. And there were a couple of other things I want to mention. Number one, Jussie Smollett's trial. Remember, he staged that fake hate crime because he wanted to make more money in his TV job? His trial began with jury selection today. And then there's Ghislaine Maxwell, the daughter of the big newspaper baron, no longer with us, Robert Maxwell, but also the pimp for Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein was, of course, the man convicted of obtaining sex from children. A lot of us believe that based on his history, that he had obtained sex from an awful lot of children and that he should have gone to prison a long time ago. He allegedly committed suicide while in custody. Most of us don't believe that Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide, but he was a very wealthy guy, and he was very well connected. He was connected to Bill Gates, and nobody quite understands that connection, that Gates kept going to his house for dinner because he thought he could raise some money there. And the question is, how much of that is going to end up being exposed during this trial of Ghislaine Maxwell, the young lady who was Jeffrey Epstein's paramour, but also apparently is accused of trying to obtain children for Jeffrey Epstein's sexual satisfaction. That trial actually got started today. It has been in jury selection up to this point. And the only question, the biggest and most important question, is not whether or not she's guilty. I think she's guilty of sin. The question is, how much are we going to find out about Epstein's connections to powerful people like, say, Bill Clinton, who flew on Epstein's plane, the Lolita Express, at least 26 different times, according to the flight logs. I would imagine in the next few days, we're going to find out whether or not there's going to be full exposure of that or whether or not the Democrats are going to find a way to hide it. A couple of little interesting details, too. The judge in the case has now been given a big federal promotion by Joe Biden. And you wonder if there are fixes in there. And one of the prosecutors, there are three prosecutors, U.S. attorneys involved, is Maureen Comey. And if her last name sounds familiar, that's because her daddy, until he got fired for doing some things that were illegal, was the head of the FBI. Now, on that note, let's go to John, who's a naysayer. John, you know how much we love naysayers here. Welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What do you and I disagree about today?
Well, I'm not overly combative, but I think you misspoke with John Lott on the gun control. I don't think they're going to apply any of those gun control laws to private security companies, since so many prominent Democrats use them for security. And being that they're not, you might not like this term to describe them, but basically, since they're not official government agencies, they're kind of like the Democrats use a vigilante team for their private security.
Okay, I'm not sure. We didn't talk about private security, so I'm not sure what I misspoke on. But, John, if they ban private citizens from owning guns, how is a private security guard going to own a gun?
Well, I think they'll get an exception is what I'm saying. Do you agree or not?
Do you think gun control is a good idea?
Yes, it's aiming and hitting your target.
Well, I would agree with you that
good aim and getting all your shots inside the 10 ring is probably an example of good gun control. But you know what I'm talking about. The Democrats, for some reason, as John said, the polls show 91% of them support greater gun laws, restrictions on American citizens. And that's crazy, given that Americans are even less supportive of gun, so-called gun control than they were just 5 years ago. Why do you suppose the Democrats are following that course?
I believe that there should be no gun control laws that are more that wouldn't be applied to voting laws. In other words, if you want to control guns, you shouldn't have it more stringent than how you'd want to control votes to make sure that they are properly cast. And
not- That's not a bad idea at all. John, thanks very much. Not exactly the naysayer I thought we were going to get. Glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk for the past 21-plus years. I'm glad to have you with me, and if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here. 24 radio stations carry this program to every corner of this region, and we're glad to have you call in. And, of course, if you're a naysayer, that is, you disagree with my point of view, unlike other shows, unlike CNN, unlike MSNBC, alternate points of view, why, you're more welcome than anybody else. You are a naysayer, and we're glad to put naysayer calls right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Our Twitter poll today, with Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey's resignation, will there be less or more censorship coming, or about the same amount? I would argue that his replacement is likely to bring more censorship to the fore. But you can vote any way you like at Lars Larson Show. And always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, we talk a lot about government on this program. We talk a lot about the services that it's supposed to provide to citizens. I think this is one of the major failings of government, is that it takes a lot of your money and doesn't necessarily deliver what it promises to deliver. Washington State Senator Mark Schessler joins me now, a Republican representing District 9. Senator, good to have you back, and I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Wonderful Thanksgiving, and I'm doing a visit in what may be my new legislative district. We'll wait and see.
We've talked about that before. When they redraw the lines and they're Democrats, they tend not to be too kind to members of the grand old party. Let me ask you about this, though. You've pointed out that the latest revenue forecast predicts a $900 million increase in tax collections for the current budget, and the state ought to use some of that money from the sales tax on vehicles to pay for roads. Are they going to actually do that?
Well, I think the majority party is extremely reluctant to give anything back to taxpayers, but Lars, our real reserves over the next two biennium is closer to $10 billion when you add in all the pots of money. Then you throw in a $470 million caseload reduction. Now, if you have $10 billion of cushion over the next three-plus years, couldn't you afford something for highways?
I would think so.
Instead of hitting the hardworking taxpayers with 25 new taxes and fees, let's do the obvious and take it sales tax on cars.
Well, and in fact, I'd love to see if you could actually make sure the money gets spent the right way. And, Senator, last week I had a guest on from a national group, and what they do is they look at all the states and how they spend their dollars on roads. And they pointed out that some states do a very good job, and they measure it by lane miles, so they're trying to compare apples to apples. Oregon comes out about the middle at about 25. Idaho comes out ninth best in America. But right next door in Washington State, the state I live in and the state I call my home now, it comes out 42nd best in America. Not quite the bottom, but an awful long ways in the direction of the bottom. And it suggests that while the state already gets a lot of money, that it doesn't spend it on highways and roads very well.
we could firm that up as well and get even more bang for the buck.
Well, if we simply want to do what the public demands, fix the roads, add lane miles, instead of bike, pedestrian, and transit, we could have an unsurpassed highway system that would serve our constituents. But right now, there are a whole lot of people led by Jay Inslee that think that bicycle and pedestrian will move our goods and people every day of the week.
Now, there's no proof of that at all, is there? I mean, does Jay Inslee even have any evidence that if we had really, really great bike paths or walking paths, that somehow that's going to boost the economy? Because things and people, for the most part, move in private vehicles.
Well, absolutely. And if you go to the sales tax on automobiles, you can humor Jay Inslee with an electric and you'll pay your share. You can buy a $2,500 get a family to work car or anything else, and it's eminently fair. It will get people there, whether it's the most environmentally conscious or the least. They have freedom and they have roads paid for something that has a real nexus.
Well, and when people keep telling me about electric cars, Senator, if people chose to buy electric cars on their own, I'd be fine with that. The problem is, even when you slap subsidies all over them and give them favored parking spaces, favored treatment on HOV lanes, favored treatment by giving them free fuel in most cases, even with all that, electric cars are not selling as well as the liberals would like to have you believe. They say, well, I mean, I think Obama had set the goal of having 1 million electric cars on the road. I think it was by 2015. We didn't even come close. And the cities of Portland and Seattle have both set goals of saying we want this many electric cars on the road. And even with all those little assists that they get, people aren't choosing to buy electric cars. And especially here in the Northwest, where the distances can be pretty daunting if you have to recharge every couple of hundred miles.
Well, we need to get to unsubsidized, free, fair, and flat market taxes on transportation. If you have a level playing field and you want to buy it, God bless you. But don't force somebody to take a heavily subsidized product and take away from their hardworking family's disposable income.
I also wonder, Senator, that heroin dealers, as I understand it, oftentimes will give you the first shot or two for free because they know once they got you hooked that you're in there. And I wonder how all these people who drive electrics now, who get a free plug-in and free juice away from home and things like that, how are they going to react if they ever get to their goals and have, 5 or 10% of the cars on the road, which is a long ways from now? And then all of a sudden, I don't think they're going to keep giving away the juice for free.
Well, I think here's one of the irritating little things that Senator Jeff Wilson told me. He said, in Olympia, the Capitol generally doesn't charge for electricity. Big mistake. But the Capitol neighborhood owners come and charge their vehicles for free in the interim, especially at night, at taxpayer expense. That's just wrong. And if we look at the brownouts that we had this past summer, what if we had, say, 5,000 electric cars charging in that part of Spokane that had rolling brownouts? You got a really big problem, and nobody wants to address that either.
No, and pretty soon your car in the driveway without power turns into a great big brick. And I'm sure they're going to push this on the Uber and Lyft folks as well. Senator Schessler, thanks so much. Coming up in a moment, should King County businesses face big fines if they refuse to become the vaccine police for the government? We'll get to that in your phone calls up next at 866-HEY-LARS. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday, and I'll tell you what, the big development today on the vaccine front is not Omicron or Omicron or however you wanted to pronounce it. Just don't pronounce it the way the president did, Omicron. I have no idea what that is. But the federal court that came out and said, no, you cannot have a vaccine mandate on federal employees, and you can't have it on employees who work in the healthcare system. The federal court dismantled Joe Biden's vaccine mandate. They didn't just say it's not legal, it's not constitutional. They noted that the Biden administration has not been able to show any evidence at all that having that mandate in place for vaccine reduces transmission of COVID. That is a major ruling. The lawyers are all looking at this saying, this is going to set the tone for a lot of the other federal court cases. And on that note, I thought I'd talk about King County. There's something going on in King County. I have a feeling this is where we're going to see the rubber meet the road. King County businesses that have repeatedly chose not to enforce the county's COVID-19 vaccine verification mandate may be facing fines and temporary closure. About a month after the policy took effect, Public Health, Seattle and King County released an enforcement plan last week that outlined the steps. This is just before Thanksgiving, that they will take to ensure that businesses are checking customer compliance. The county requires people 12 and older to verify that they are fully vaccinated or provide a negative test result to access any large outdoor public events or indoor establishments, including restaurants, gyms, and theaters, starting on the 6th of December, next week. The mandate will apply to small restaurants and bars that seat fewer than 12 people. So, King County businesses are going to be told, you are becoming the vax police. So, consider what the federal courts just said to the Biden administration. Making everybody get the vaccine does not slow down transmission. You haven't shown us any evidence of that whatsoever. Meanwhile, King County is saying, and we're going to force all of our private businesses to become the vaccine police on behalf of the government. And if they don't do it, we're going to go in and hit them with fines that if the last year and a half hasn't put them out of business, may put them out of business altogether. Now, if that makes sense to any of you, doesn't make any sense to me, but I'd love to hear the naysayer explain why this is a good idea. That is, businesses that have survived over the last 18 months are now saying, well, we're going to see if we can get through the next 18 months. And then King County comes along and says, number one, you're going to start punishing your customers. And if you don't, we're going to punish you. And we may put you out of business altogether. If anybody thinks that makes a lot of sense, call me up at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. Grant's on the line from Renton. Hey, Grant, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
I appreciate it, and I think you're doing a good job there. Keep it up.
Thank you, sir.
Inflation's in the news all of a sudden the last couple of weeks, although it's been going on for the last decade probably or longer. Most people don't realize what it's doing to them. For example, it's my understanding, maybe you can verify it, that somebody gets $40 for every COVID vaccination that's given out free with my money.
Well, you say somebody. Do you mean they're paying the pharmacy to give the shot?
Yeah, I think the government pays Walgreens the $40.
Yeah, I think they are paying. I mean, would you expect them to do it for free?
No, I wouldn't, but I think when you're aligning people up and putting them through a couple hundred an hour, that they should be able to do it for less than $40 a shot.
You might be surprised when people price things out, because you say, well, you know, because I don't know, Grant, we could get into a long discussion of what it costs a business to do something. When you go in and say, we'd like to add to the list of things that your employees already do, and you're already paying bricks and mortar costs, you're already paying employees, you're already paying for all these other costs, and then we want you to do a few shots. And they say it's no big deal. As one of my friends once loved to say, everything is easy as long as you don't have to do it. But when somebody comes in and says, I want your business to take on these additional tasks, most businesses expect to be paid to do that kind of work. And when you add to the tasks of employees, I don't employ anybody who isn't busy all day long. If you don't believe me, ask my producers. They would tell you we're busy all day long. Lars pays for our time, and he keeps us busy. And it's not just busy work, it's actually doing things. But when you said that inflation's probably been going on for a decade, yeah, except that over about the last 20 years, inflation has been clocking along at about 2% a year, which is not gigantic. It means that if your paycheck goes up by 2% and the economy and the inflation goes up by 2%, you stay about level. And if the boss thinks you're worth more, then you get 3% or 4%. But when you see an annual rate, like October's number was an annual rate of 10% inflation, do you think anybody's going to get a 10% raise in the next 12 months to make up for that 10% increase in the cost of living?
No, and that's a problem. But all these people are going to have to strike to try and get that 10% raise, and they'll end up 5%.
I don't know. Why do they have to strike? If you sit down with the boss and say, boss, I need to make more money. If the boss can pay you more, he probably will. But the problem is, like your understanding of business, is if you say, yeah, the boss, he's a guy who has this big closet in his office and it's full of $100 bills. And every time the cost of something goes up, he just gets a big shovel and shovels out $100 bills till it gets paid. That's not the way it works. When you're running a business, there's a certain amount of money that comes in the front door from your customers, and there's a certain amount of money that goes out the back door or another door to pay for your rent, pay for your employees, pay for your insurance, and all the other costs of running the business. And if there isn't enough money coming in the front door, and most businesses have seen reductions in business, there are a few that have prospered during the pandemic, but most saw a reduction in business. If they don't have the additional money to raise people's wages, in many cases, they just get rid of the job, or they automate it, or they hire it out to somebody else. And so when you say, well, we'll just go on strike, well, good luck with that. If the money ain't coming in the front door, it can't go in your pocket. Does that make sense?
It does. That's why I say they'll only get 5% of a 10% increase.
Yeah, which means Joe Biden has just hit them with a hidden tax of 5% of everything they make. And how do you suppose most people are going to react to that?
That's my point. Most people don't understand it. And that's what I'm trying to get the message out there.
Well, do you understand where most of that inflation is coming from?
I think I do. And that's another.
Tell me where it's coming from. I've got my own ideas, but I'd like to hear yours. Where do you think that what is driving that inflation?
The relief packages that they're sending out. When you send money in the mail for people that don't do any work, that's inflation.
Yes, well, that's part of it. You can also get inflation because, Grant, energy costs have gone up dramatically. Gasoline famously is 50% higher than it was a year ago on average. And since almost every business has to use fuel and energy to make it go, you've got to have fuel for the trucks, fuel for the people, the folks who drive around as part of their work. And when electric goes up, natural gas goes up, oil goes up, diesel goes up, gasoline goes up, that's a piece of the inflation. And an awful lot of what has driven that are the lunatic policies of Joe Biden, who decided his first day in office to stick a knife in the back of the fossil fuel business, which he hates, and make everybody's costs go up. And then people are surprised when everything costs more. Grant, thanks for the call. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails. I guess I have to put this in context. I have a Twitter account. I also have a Getter account and a number of other accounts. And you might say, well, I'm not on Twitter. I don't like them. Why should this matter to me that Jack Dorsey is stepping down as the CEO for Twitter if it doesn't really affect me directly? Well, I would point you in the direction of the now infamous laptop story originated by one of America's oldest newspapers, the New York Post, which published the story. But then because of Twitter's censorship, it didn't get to most of America. And it certainly didn't get to a lot of voters. And I've seen some interesting polls about that after the election when they went out to ask Democrats, so who'd you vote for? I voted for Biden. People would tell the pollster, and they'd say, did you know about the laptop story? No. And then they'd give them the gist of it and say, would you have voted differently if you'd known about it? And an awful lot of them said yes. Jeff Brain is the founder of the social media app Cloud Hub, and he joins me now. Jeff, thanks for coming on the show for a few minutes to talk about Jack Dorsey stepping down. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What should we make of the departure of Jack Dorsey, and does this mean Twitter becomes a less censorship social media presence on the internet, or does it mean the censorship gets even worse under his successor?
Right. Well, first thing we should make of it is, we just saw Facebook change their name. Now you have Jack Dorsey stepping down, and what it tells us is that anti-free speech platforms it's not good for business, let me say that, in America and most of the world, we all aspire to freedom. We all want free speech, and people believe in fairness, and these platforms at their core are about expressing yourself. So for them to be censoring, like you said, the New York Post, removing Donald Trump from their platform, you know, in the end, people will not support that. And I think you're seeing that. And now, will it change the behavior? Actually, in November of 2020, the replacement CEO actually said, our role is not to be bound by the First Amendment, focusing less on thinking about free speech, but thinking about how the times have changed. I don't know what the end of that statement means, but I certainly know what the first part says. And anybody thinking there's going to be a change at Twitter is mistaken. It sounds like it's deeply ingrained in their culture that they decide what values and views get expressed on their platform.
I think you and I might have the same impression of the tail end of that statement about how the times have changed, saying we're now all woke, or we should be woke, and if you're not woke already, we're going to make you woke. But the idea, I'm not saying a private company is bound by the First Amendment. The First Amendment constrains government's control of my speech and my religious practice and everything else. But the government gives some really special favors to the social media giants, including protection against defamation and things like that, without which I don't think they could actually operate. So to the extent that they're getting these special privileges and they've promised to act as platforms, meaning we're the empty blackboard that a small community might put up saying anybody can write anything they want up there. And then all of a sudden you say, well, Lars or Jeff is writing things up there we don't like. You say, well, we told everybody they could write whatever they want. That's the promise we have to hold to, isn't it? Except the social media giants have decided that they're going to take their own liberal politics to a large extent, and they're going to let those be displayed. And anybody who speaks otherwise, they're going to be silenced because, as you said, that sentence that ended with, because of the way times have changed. Is that the way you read it?
Well, certainly, you know, I think Jack has stepped down because I think the writing's on the wall. You know, their platform has had, you know, through a series of bad decisions and a failure to innovate, really got stalled at about 300 million people while most of the other major platforms went on to a billion plus. And now when you think about what they did last year is they removed all the popular people that conservatives wanted to follow, including the president, General Flynn, you know, Sidney Powell, you name it, there's a whole slew of them. Well, they kind of shot themselves in the foot because now if you go on Twitter, it's kind of boring. It's empty. There's nothing really happening. And I think that Jack Dorsey saw the writing on the wall when President Trump comes out with Truth Social early part of next year. I think that's the nail in the coffin for Twitter.
And does True Social manage to avoid the kind of behavior that the other social media giants have engaged in? Because I think it'd be great if they did, or if it did, but it takes some real guts to say we're going to stick to our guns and we'll actually behave the way we've promised to behave. Well, doesn't it?
It does, but I think it's based on your principles. You know, when Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg started their platforms, they were in college, they were young, and they've developed their values and principles while they've built their platforms, right? And they've kind of gone off the rails. I think President Trump, and I know myself, you know, at CloudHub, you know, those principles of free speech and protecting privacy are ingrained in who I am. And so it's not hard at all, actually, to stick to those principles if those are your principles.
Yeah.
I don't believe those are their principles.
and I'm sure they get it. I mean, Jeff, one of the principles of this show that's 25 years old next year is naysayers go to the head of the line. So if somebody calls up and tells my producer that Lars, he's full of garbage, and I want to tell him that, they say, great, you get to go next. And then I let them make their argument. And then I ask questions, as the lawyers like to say, in aid of an objection. And I tell them that's part of the deal. You get a chance to have a platform to say whatever you want to say and tell everybody how wrong I am about whatever it is we disagree on. But then I get to ask you some questions because I may try to show that you know, your point of view maybe isn't well-founded in facts or logic or the law. But at least they get a chance to do that. Try finding that on MSNBC or CNN. The old legacy media suffers from this in spades. And then you've got the
right.
New social media giants that say, and we're going to suffer from it too. I just don't understand how they don't see this isn't a good business model.
No, it's not a good business model. And even if it's not, you know, illegal to censor people, because you're right, businesses have, you know, greater ability to decide you're on their platform or not. There is a sense of of, even though it may not be legal, of what's right and what's fair. And when people see voices being silenced, inherently, we have to say, I'm next. You know, if they're willing to silence President Trump, who is president of the United States, then what would they do to me or you?
It also reminds me of, I mean, to use a simple comparison, somebody opens a comedy club and they start stocking the comedy club with a lot of comics who are really, really out there. They're really controversial and their club is just overflowing with customers. And then you say, oh, no, some of these people are controversial. Let's get rid of all the controversial ones and let's just have nice, safe, non-offensive comics. That club's going out of business. But would you mind telling my audience quickly what CloudHub is all about?
Yeah, I wanted to create a different kind of social media platform. Social media has tremendous ability to bring people together, but what are we bringing them together for? So I created CloudHub as a place where we can connect people and socialize in a meaningful way with their friends, family, and neighbors, but go beyond that. We give you the tools that when there are issues that you're concerned about, that you can connect, collaborate, and address the issues that impact your lives, communities, and our country. And when I started building it in 2018, I had no idea how really important it would be in 2021. But people are organizing on our platform. They can do groups. We have channels. We have CloudHub events, which is kind of a combination of Zoom and Clubhouse. A lot of tools where people can actually address the issues they care about. And ultimately, as we continue to build CloudHub, we're going to connect our members to the things in life that shape their lives and build society up. That's what social media should be. There'll be a faith hub, there'll be a civic hub, there'll be an education hub, entertainment hub, sports hub, health, business, finance, all the things that we need in life in a meaningful, purposeful way that you can access on social media. That's what it should be.
And don't have all that censorship that is ruining Twitter and those other social media giants. That's Jeff Brain. Hey, Jeff, thanks very much. I appreciate the time. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And as we always say, naysayers go to the head of the line on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Got an interesting email. I'm going to leave the young lady's name off of this. But, Lars, I just wanted to comment on what a caller said to you on the air about going to your boss and asking for a cost of living increase. You said if your boss can afford it, he probably will. Well, I use the example of Walmart as a big example. They got a big tax savings out of the Donald Trump tax cuts that happened years ago, and they passed along about $1 billion to their workers. Well, the email says, well, I recently went to my boss on several occasions to talk about just that. We're a small company. She says they're very profitable, but the boss said I can afford a 1.5% to 2% cost of living raise. All shot down. So at the end of the day, what's happening with inflation and the rest of the country is completely out of his control, so he doesn't have to make decisions about benefiting his employees. Well, I've always thought of this as, in fact, there's a great John Wayne scene from a movie in which a guy says, oh, so you're going to give me a job. He says, I'm not giving you anything. We are exchanging something. You work for me. I pay you. It's an exchange. And if you think of it as the boss giving you something, the boss isn't there to be Santa Claus. The boss is there to say, I have this much money coming in. I need this work done. I will exchange money for labor. It's very, very simple economics. Now, if your boss says, I'm not going to pay you more and your skills are worth more, and the only way you can know that, how do you judge the value of anything? I've had people tell me my classic Mustang is worth $50,000. And I say, oh, great. That's good. Good for you. Who offered you 50 grand? Well, nobody, but I've looked it up and I think it's worth 50,000. I said, you should test that sometime. See if you offer it for 52,000 and see if you get any buyers, any offers at all. If you don't, it ain't worth 50,000. Something is worth whatever someone is willing to pay for it. And as far as I'm concerned, and at the risk of maybe making your boss mad, if you think the boss is not paying you what your skills and talents are really worth, you should sell them to somebody else. In other words, take your labor and find a different job and say to your boss, boss, you weren't paying me what I was worth. I found somebody who will. If you say I'm not willing to do that, then you're getting what your skills are worth right there. And that's my view of it anyway. Let's go to JC. Hey, JC, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Yes, good afternoon, JC. Thank you, Lars, sorry.
I can be JC if you like. Go ahead.
Well, no, you don't want to be
for a while.
For a while, yeah. And I couldn't be Lars. That'd be really hard to do. But anyways, do you think that we should run the country on Twitter?
No, but then again, we run the country as a republic if you can keep it.
Then that should be the end of that discussion, right?
Well, no. Any more than if you ask me, Lars, should we run the country based on television and newspapers and radio? I'd say no, but they aren't intended to be the government of the country. They're intended to be a method of communication. Well, right,
they're not part of the government, right? I didn't say they were part of the government.
You set up a straw man, JC. I've never said.
No, you that, did. You did. You Lars.
How? How did I do that?
You did. By comparing the other networks with the government. That's a straw man argument.
No, hold on.
The newspaper.
Where did I compare the government?
You mentioned that the television, the newspaper, and all that. Are part of the government run?
No, I did not. Well, no. Well, hold on. One qualification to that, JC. Okay. What I said was that if you start a newspaper tomorrow, nobody in the government can tell you you can't run a newspaper. Now, if you hire employees, you may be under the guise of the government because the government will tell you how you have to treat your employees. You may have to buy workers' comp and things like that. But if you start a social media platform like Twitter or Facebook, you are protected. You have special protection given to you by the government. It's called Section 230 of the Communications Act. And what it says is, JC, right now, if you defame somebody on my show, and it's your words and your mouth that defame them, you know who gets the blame? I do.
You do.
I have to. Right. Yes. Somebody could say, why JC went on and said so-and-so is a convicted child molester, and he's not, and he's now lost his job because you let some idiot from Umatilla, call him a child molester, and he's not a child molester. That'd be simple defamation, where somebody suffers harm.
Thank God for laws, right?
But listen, I have to be responsible for everything that goes on this show. Now, do you think Jack Dorsey has to be responsible for everything people say on Twitter?
Yes.
He does not. Because of Section 230.
I get what the section means, but you know, morally, you know what we mean too, right?
It doesn't matter about morals. What matters is if you're running a business and you can't be sued for defamation, that is a tremendous advantage. And the social media platform said, we're platforms. We'll put whatever people say up. But if we're going to do that, government, you have to give us protection from liability for saying defamatory things about people. So the government gave that to this. They did not give it to Fox News. They didn't give it to the Lars Larson show. They didn't give it to the Seattle Times. If the Seattle Times publishes a letter to the editor that's defamatory, the Seattle Times get fired. If Jack Dorsey publishes somebody's comments that are defamatory, Jack Dorsey does not get sued because of Section 230. We agreed to give go ahead.
If Jack Dorsey posted that the last election was fraud and there was the election fraud, he probably would be banned.
But that's not defamatory. We have to talk about the protection they get from the government means they get some special privileges from the government in exchange for agreeing to behave like a platform, which they are not any longer. You got the Lars Larson Show.